Well, Darius, thank you so much for being on today. I'm excited to dive into things and hear a little bit more of your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mike. Happy to be here.
So you've done incredible things. I mean, you're up to a point of having a really successful podcast. You've had some incredible businesses that you built up over time, but it hasn't always been that way. It's been kind of a journey for you to get to that stage. Can you kind of walk us through what that journey has been like?
Yeah, you know, so I'm a serial entrepreneur. I grew up with my dad being an entrepreneur, so I was one of like the few people whose dads didn't have a job. You know, my dad owned his own business, and that didn't realize it till later that was unusual. For me, that was just kind of the norm. So I was probably around 19, 20 years old when I realized that I was probably never going to have a job, and started doing real entrepreneurial things outside of like having a small little businesses when you're a kid. And I started off just really trying a lot of different stuff, ended up in the world of mortgage lending when I was 25. And, you know, I'm fast forwarding for a 6-year period of me trying a lot of different entrepreneurial things. And right now, nowadays, a 19-year-old can, you know, you can have your own YouTube channel. You can have a digital marketing business. You can do a lot of stuff. You have social media where you can promote products. You know, I'm 45 years old. So 26 years ago in 1997, it was all analog. You know, the internet was new. And so it was expensive to set up a website. So that was not the norm. That was more the exception. The norm was more brick and mortar, you know, analog type businesses. And so I tried a lot of different stuff, but I ended up in the world of mortgage lending. I have a twin brother who's been my long-term business partner. He did not go to college. I did go to college. And he was doing really well as a loan officer in a mortgage business. He was making over $100,000 a year. This is a long time ago. This is 25 years ago. And we were young. We were, you know, in our early 20s. And so
what were some of those early ventures you started or experimented with?
Oh, I had a multi-level marketing business that I bought into where I was selling like basically, I can't remember the name of it, but it was essentially like how to not pay taxes, you know? And so I was sending like postcards out to people to try to get people to buy it. And I think once I broke even, I sold it to another friend of mine and I got out of it. But I had stuff like that. My brother and I started a nightclub business where we were doing nightclub promotions and we were doing DJ parties. That was actually my first business that failed. We lost about $100,000 in that business. And, you know, a lot of stuff was just sales jobs, you know, just like jobs that were commission only. Everything from selling electronics to, you know, working and selling gym memberships. And so a lot of it was always sales oriented, and it was always, you know, where you kind of killed what you ate, right? But I did all sorts of things. I tried starting a personal training business. I got my personal training certification when I was a junior in college. I tried starting a personal training business. You know, I hung up posters all over my college campus that said, "Look better naked," and got torn down and got in trouble for it. So, I mean, I was always trying to do different stuff.
Sounds like you're a bit of a maverick. Like what was going through your mind? Why not get a quote unquote normal job like everyone else?
I mean, I had jobs. Well, so first of all, I was a hustler. So I had three jobs, I was paying my way through college. So I had a job at a nightclub as a doorman. I did tax returns for one of my professors. I was an accounting major. And then I had an internship at a couple different agencies because I was looking at advertising. I actually interned at the White House as a White House intern for the Clinton administration.
So wait, let's pause for a moment there. You interned at the White House? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so when I was probably 20, 19 years old, and a friend of mine who was really into politics, I was in student government in high school. She ended up going to USC, University of Southern California, and she was really, really into politics. She still is, actually. And she ended up going to go to a White House internship, and she's a friend of mine. I said, "Hey, you got to give me a White House internship." And so she, long story short, she ended up inviting her boss to come hang out with us at this place that was very popular at the time in LA called Dublin's. It was on Sunset Boulevard. And we went out and partied. We went out and drinking and with this guy who was working at the White House. And I ran into a bunch of girls who I went to college with. And I'm like, "Hey, go hit on that guy." And so, he had a really fun night. And I helped facilitate that. And I said, "Hey, man, you got to get me an internship at the White House." Now, look, I had good grades and I had a bunch of internships and stuff. So it's not like I wasn't qualified necessarily. But, you know, it's like anything, like businesses, relationships. And he said, "Yeah, when you're interested, send me your application. I'll hand deliver it." So he did that. I ended up working in the Office of Presidential Scheduling for the Clinton administration, which basically means, again, this is back then, like they were working in like a DOS-based system. And for people that don't know what that means, it's like it was like there's no user interface, right? It was all like just there was no. It's hard to explain for people that don't know what I'm talking about, but imagine the internet where there's nothing, there's no actual like graphics. I guess that's the best way to describe it, right? And so, we were getting, you know, the president of the United States, you may or may not know this, gets a lot of requests for to be a part of a lot of events. Mm-hmm. Like not just the ones that you see on TV where they're going to these like, you know, presidential events at like on the world stage. They get invited to, you know, Jimmy John's barbecue and to little Susie's second birthday and to, you know, the bake sale at the church. Like the president of the United States gets invited for every stupid event you could imagine. And I say stupid as like graciously as possible. And so someone has to answer. So every single one of those requests gets a response. And the people that do those responses are the interns. And so I worked in the Office of Presidential Scheduling where we were in charge of responding to every single one of those requests. Every now and again, a request would come in that was an important one, like the prince from Zimbabwe or somebody would ask the president to come to an event. And we'd have to like pull those letters out of, and back then this is all physical letters, right? These were actual physical pieces of mail because email was still kind of new. And so we're responding to each of these pieces. I quickly was like, man, this sucks. This is the worst job because back then they didn't pay you. So you were like actually paying to live in DC, which is expensive. You're going to work for free and, you know, you're doing grunt work unless your parents were someone important in the government. So there was a lot of kids there whose parents were like in, this is the Democratic Party, who were high up in the DNC and they would get better jobs. They'd work in the West Wing. They would work directly for one of the, you know, advisors to the president. My parents were nobodies, so I got to sort mail and work in essentially the mail room. And I said, you know, this is the worst. I can't believe I signed up for this. So I quickly figured out that the interns voted for a president of the interns. And so I ran against this dorky kid from Harvard and actually won president of the interns, so which meant I got to put on all the events for the interns for the whole summer, and basically I ran their social life. Now, back in school, I was a, you know, throwing nightclub parties. So this went really well hand in hand with like a skill set I already had. So I spent the rest of, it got me out of the mailroom. I spent the rest of the summer throwing parties for the interns all over DC. I got access to the West Wing. I got to sit in with the high level advisors and I made the most of it, but it was an interesting experience. I will tell you this though. I learned one thing, Mike. I learned that I told myself this. I said, wow, I realized that I never wanted to work for anybody ever again at that moment. It was probably the first and last job I ever had where I actually had to show up to work at a certain time and have a specific, you know, boss I'd asked permission from. And I told myself, I said, the only way you could ever get me back at the White House is if I was president of the United States. So I was 22, you know, that was kind of a bold statement and feelings, but I was just kind of following my intuition, and that's where I landed. So I knew at that point, I'm like, I can't work for other people.
And do you have any dream in the future to become president?
Oh gosh, you know, if they didn't ruin your life in the process of doing it, I probably would consider it. But I think people's lives get ruined, and I've done too many things in my life that they would question, that I just don't want to have to, you know, I don't want to have to defend being who I am.
Sure.
And so I've decided at this stage that that's probably not on the table, but you never know. Anything's possible.
When you were in the White House, were there any interesting surprises or things that people don't typically know or understand about the White House?
There was three things that I found to be really interesting. Number one was that I'd never met so many people from Little Rock, Arkansas in my entire life. So half of the people there were from Arkansas because the president was from Arkansas. So they're doing, you know, favors for his donors' kids and stuff. I'm like, man, there's a lot of people from Little Rock, Arkansas here. I mean, literally it was like half the people. So that was surprising to me. Number two was that they had a machine. Again, this is 23 years ago, that would sign the president's signature. So it was a signature pen. It was like a robot that would sign his signature on every single piece of mail that went out. So that was very surprising to me that they would actually do that. So all the letters we would write, we would turn them in and the machine would sign them, and you'd actually get like an actual wet signature, but it was a machine that did it. And it was just a big robotic thing that just like acted like a hand. So that was kind of interesting. And the one that was probably most interesting to me was that there's a call center in the White House. So anyone can call the White House. There's an actual phone number. I think it's like 202-456-1212. We could Google that right now. but the White House has an actual phone number. So let's look it up. The White House, I'm going to Google it. Do you mind if I do this?
Yeah, go for it.
White House phone number. Let's see if I remembered it correctly. Oh my gosh, I almost had it. It was 202-456-1111. So pretty good. It was 23 years ago. I still remember the phone number almost. So yeah, 202-456-1111. You could call the White House right now. So if you call the White House, they have an actual call center that people are working in. And it was mostly like senior citizens, but I got to work in the White House call center, which was like not that big. When I say call center, it's not that big of a, it's like a couple rooms. And you would have to answer calls. And so you can imagine all sorts of people call the White House. Mostly people, there's a ton of crazies that call the White House. So you get on the phone with people and like, you know, you gotta be polite to them because you're representing the White House, but they would be, you know, and they would give us instruction if someone threatens the president's life, like how to escalate it and stuff like that. So that was actually pretty interesting job. The other thing that I found to be really interesting was that most people assume that people that work in the White House actually work in the White House. Next to the White House is a building called the OEOB, Old Executive Office Building. It's a four-story like building. It's a gray building. And that's where almost all the White House staff works. And so only the most important people work in the West Wing in the White House. Very few people work there. Most are working in the OEOB. And so, but you have to go, but it's on the same property. You just don't see it. Like no one ever sees that, but that's actually part of the White House. That's where most of the employees there work. So I worked in the OEOB and then we go into the West Wing to deliver the president's schedule and stuff like that.
Did you get to meet the president? Or
yeah, that was the other thing that was surprising is at least when I was there, he was barely there.
Oh really?
Yeah, I was there the summer of 2000. It was his last summer in office and he was barely there. He was in Europe on a tour for almost the entire 3 months I was there. He was there a couple times, and it's like a big deal. Like he has a photographer that follows him every single ounce and second of the day. So if he's taking pictures and if you get an official White House picture with him, like they'll send it to you directly. It was very hard to get that. We got to take a picture with the president now, which actually ended up being a big scandal.
Really?
Because you're supposed to get a picture. The White House, when you intern at the White House, you get a picture standing in front of the South Lawn, which is the picture we all know of the White House, which is like the pillars. And that's the back of the White House facing the South Lawn. That year, they ended up having a like carnival or something the day that we're supposed to take our picture. Now, mind you, we're like working for free. We're living there the whole summer. We're paying our own way. And the one souvenir we get is a picture with us and the president. There's like probably 100 interns standing with the president of the United States in front of the White House facing the South Lawn. And they're like, oh yeah, this year you're not going to get that. You're going to get taken on the steps of the OEOB on the Old Executive Office Building. And now at this time in my life, my dad was actually dying at home at my house in California. And so I was away from home. My father was literally dying. In fact, I had to leave the internship early because he died like within the time frame I was supposed to have my internship. So I it was a kind of a traumatic time in my life. I decided to like leave to go do this because I thought it was an important thing to do despite my dad's like health. And I kind of snapped. I was like, this is bullshit. Like, this is like the one thing we get, like, this is unfair. So I sent this like scathing email.
Not a letter?
But no. We had email in the White House. So we all had our own emails, but it was an internal, it wasn't like an email system like you would think of today. It was like this old DOS-based email system. So I sent an email to all the interns because I was the president of the interns. So I had access to everyone's email saying how lucky the White House was to have us and that they were disrespecting us as interns and that they owed us this. And it went viral all over the White House. And so I basically got pulled aside. They were going to fire. I think they were going to kick me out of my internship, but they found out that my dad was sick and I got a hall pass. Now, 2 days later, I ended up having to go home anyway because my father was so ill. But yeah, I actually almost got fired from the White House now that I think about it.
You are a maverick. That's crazy. I love it. You know, back when you were in the mailroom and receiving all these invites, did you ever Did you ever schedule the president to go see some random miscellaneous birthday party? Did he ever do stuff like that?
No, not at all. So we didn't actually do the scheduling. We just responded to the mail, and then we would escalate letters based off of, I mean, again, most of 99% of the letters were just blanket responses. We had to give a personalized response. Now, one thing to keep in mind though, is if you're getting a letter from the White House, you have to imagine, again, there's no spell check. This is not done in any type of, it wasn't even Microsoft Word back then. Like that we were using, it was some other like software that we're using to type into that was DOS based. So one intern would like respond like, thank you so much. It was a form thing. We'd kind of fill in. Thank you so much, Mike, for your request for the president to go to your barbecue at the church. You know, unfortunately, as you can imagine, the president's a very busy person. He would love, however, he's so grateful for the request. Best of luck to you and the congregation. Right. So there's like these blanks we got to fill in. And then you print it, and because it's a letter, it's a physical letter, and then you got to imagine you can't have any typos in these letters because it's coming from the President of the United States.
Oh, sure.
So we would have to like triple edit these things. Like you put it in a pile, three other people would look at it, and then if it was messed up, you'd have to redo it. So it was this like super manual. This is why I hated the job so much. I'm like, this is like mind-numbing work. So that's all we did until I figured out. That was all I did for the first week or two. And I was like, I'm not doing this. I got to figure a way out of this.
And then you became president of the interns.
So I became president of the interns, which ended up being a pretty fun job.
So when you nearly got fired, I mean, what's going through your mind? So you send this letter out to all the interns, kind of riling them up and getting viral in the area. But what's going through your mind when they call you to the office? What happened in that moment?
I just didn't care. I was like, I really thought it was an injustice. And I said that to him. I said, you know, we're coming here. We're spending our own money. I mean, for me, it was my graduation present. You know, like it was go to Europe or go do this. So, you know, I was like, I took the $5,000 that my parents had, you know, given me as a graduation gift and used it to go work at the White House for the summer. So I was like, man, I'm sacrificing a lot to be here. And this is an injustice. So I end up, you know, later on in life getting very involved with this idea of living a core value driven existence. Mm-hmm. But and we could talk about that just because you probably know, if you looked into me, you know that I wrote a book about this. And yeah. So for at that point, like I always tell people, you know that a value is a value that based on if something, how you react to something negative, you know, it's usually a violation of a value. And for me, it was this value. I have this, you know, core value around doing the right thing. And I was just like, this is not the right thing. Like they're completely dismissing what everyone has sacrificed to come do this. And the one thing we get is a picture. So I was just like, I didn't care. I'm like, what are they going to do? I'm not planning on working here. I'm not planning on working in DC. I'm not trying to have, and it's amazing. The kids that do these internships are like, have you ever watched the TV show House of Cards?
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey. It's a bunch of like, they're literally like that, like these 22, and they're all from Yale and Harvard and Cornell and Stanford. And they're just like looking for ways to make you look bad and make them look good. And I was just like, I opted out. I was like, I'm like, these people are first, and they're all kind of nerdy, you know, because they're all from these Ivy League schools. I'm like, man, there's a ton of nerds here and they're like vicious. And so I was, but I was kind of a jock and, you know, like I wasn't willing to play the game. So I just didn't care. I was like, I have nothing to lose. Like I'm not planning on a career in politics. So like, what do I have to lose? Screw these people.
Why did they back out and not actually fire you?
I ended up talking to like one of the head admins, like, you know, one of the staffers, who was probably a middle-aged guy at that point. You know, I mean, when you're 20, everyone who's 40 looks like they're 60, you know? So he was probably 40 something. And I think they knew it was up. Like my dad was dying legitimately. Mm. And I think I got a hall pass because of that. And so I think they found out, they knew that, you know, and the guy just said, hey man, this is the White House. You can't rock the boat. And I got it when he said that. I was like, you know, it was a emotional reaction. I still don't think I was wrong. And this is 25 years ago, 23 years ago. I still don't think I was wrong.
Did you ever get the photo?
I did get the photo. But it was in standing in front of the old executive office building.
Oh,
yeah. I don't have it hung up in my house. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's with me with the president, like eight rows down from me. but it was a cool experience. I mean, like, look, looking back, I'm glad I did it. Taught me a lot. The biggest thing it taught me was that I was kind of unemployable, you know, and I've always been a person that kind of has to carve out my own path. And that served me really, really well after that, you know.
So let's dive into that. So you're unemployable. You have to carve your own path. What path did you end up carving?
So I ended up going home. My dad passed away, you know, right after I got home. And I was 22. I have a twin brother who's 22. My sister was 16. You know, my mom at that point was probably in her late 40s. And it was a pretty sad time in our household. So I stayed home for a year. Now I'd gone away to college for a few years. And so I was back home, which anyone that's done that knows that's pretty depressing. Unless you live in like New York City or something like that, which I didn't. I lived in Orange County, California. And I spent a year and I was pretty depressed. I just didn't do much. I had this business, this nightclub business that we were trying to get off the ground. It ended up failing about 9 months later, which was my first big six-figure failure in business. I had when my father passed away, I inherited some money and I lost all of it. Oh. And it was really depressing. And so about a year later, it was probably this is August of 2000. By June of 2001, I had tried up my first job in the mortgage business at that point. My brother, who was very successful at that point in the business, got me a job. I got fired from that job just because they didn't really have a trainee program. It was kind of just thrown in the deep end, and I wasn't doing well because they weren't training anybody, and it was all commission only. I got fired from that job. Our business failed, and I said, "Just get me the hell out of here! Like, I'll go anywhere." So I was scouring the internet, applying to any job. Most people don't know this, but in the summer of 2000 was a recession because it was right after the dot-com bubble burst. So it was very hard to find a job. And I ended up applying for a job in San Francisco as a day trader, professional day trader. There was professional day trading firms that had come up during the dot-com boom. And there was a New York firm called ETG, Electronic Trading Group, that had an office in San Francisco. I applied for that job in like June. I got an interview. I drove up to San Francisco in July. And they offered me a job. And so I said, I'm out of here. And so I ended up moving into a house with seven other roommates. It was eight of us in one house, all age ranges. And there was a TV show at the time called The Real World that was on MTV for people that remember. And it was like, I said, oh, this is like The Real World. Like, it's all sorts of people from all walks of life. There's eight people, ages probably like early 20s to early 40s. And there's literally eight people living in a house together. And I lived in this home, and I took this job as a day trader in downtown San Francisco. I ended up, the job paid no salary, no base, nothing. All it paid was you got a percentage of your profits, and you could trade with their money. And it was in downtown San Francisco off California and Battery. And I started the job September 3rd, 2001. And 8 days into my job was 9/11. So September 3rd was my first day of work. September 11th was 8 days later, a week later into my job. And for those people that don't know, when something like that happens, whether it's COVID or whether it's like the Great Recession when that happened or 9/11, it causes massive amounts of volatility in the stock market. Mm-hmm. And that's not good if you're a stock trader. It's really hard to trade that market. And it's really hard to trade that market, A, if you know what you're doing, and B, if you don't know what you're doing, which I didn't. And so, and again, I'm going to remind you, I was paid on profitability. So as you can imagine, I wasn't very profitable, but I had to pay my bills because my rent was $580 a month. I had a car payment. I had to buy food. So my overhead was about $2,500 a month that I had. My parents weren't going to give me money. It was like, I had to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I ended up working like seven jobs. So I would work seven my Wall Street
at the same time.
Well, yeah, like within a 1 week period, I had seven different jobs.
Wow.
And so I worked my Wall Street job. I'd have to leave the house at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I worked till 1:30, which is when two o'clock when the markets close, you know, because I'm Pacific Standard Time. And then I just hustled. I worked at a nightclub. I taught kids art and computers and like the Tenderloin, which is kind of a shady part of San Francisco. I did that one day a week. I worked at the nightclub 2 days a week. I would help my brother and some other loan officers in Southern California. I would order their appraisals for them. What else did I do? I ended up throwing parties. I started throwing parties again. So I threw nightclub parties. And the one that was actually the most interesting was I did focus groups. So
interesting.
I don't even know if they have those anymore, but basically a focus group, they'll hire a marketing agency, and a marketing agency will like bring you in and they'll show you their advertising and ask you their opinions. Or they'll do, back then, this is like when Big Tobacco was being sued by some huge class action lawsuits. They did like a fake Big Tobacco lawsuit, and I got to be a fake jury member. I had one where it was not American Spirits. It was Lucky Strike Cigarettes was testing out new cigarettes, and I didn't even smoke. And they're like, here, like try our cigarettes out. And they were like, and it was always like, they would put these ads on Craigslist, which again, I don't know if your listeners will know what that is, but Craigslist was very, very popular from San Francisco. So it was really big there, especially 20 years ago. It was probably one of the biggest things there. So I would go on this section called gigs, and I would look for jobs on there. And so I was just picking up side jobs all the time, and I would just hustle to make my $2,500 because I'd literally start the month at zero. I'd make $600 from teaching kids. I'd make a couple $100 from bouncing. I'd make a couple $100 from throwing parties. I'd make a couple $100 from ordering appraisals for my brother and his friends. And then I would make a few $100 doing focus groups. Now, focus groups, you're only allowed to do one every 6 months, but I just lied and I would just pretend like anything they asked for. They're like, do you have a dog? I'm like, I have a dog. I didn't have a dog. Like my roommate has a dog. I go in and they'd always pick me to go to the second and third round because I'm a pretty good actor. I was like, oh, I love my dog. His name's Vlad. He's the best. I'm literally talking about my roommate's dog as if it's mine. and I'd make like $50 for an hour. But I was hustling all this stuff. I was just doing whatever I had to do. I ended up starting a magazine, a nightclub magazine. So I was just a hustler. But what ended up happening was I got burnt out, as you can imagine. I was working about 100 hours a week, and I got burnt out pretty quick. And I ended up going to my boss and said, hey, look, man, I can't do this. Like, this is like, you're not paying me anything. I'm not making money. I was in the hole. So they ended up giving me a $1,500 a month draw, which got it where I could quit a bunch of these jobs. But I ended up taking one job for a mortgage company. So right after 9/11, the interest rates dropped, the opposite of what's happening right now.
Yeah.
They dropped from the first time ever below 7%. So right now we're back above 7%. That was the last time rates were at 7%, was 22 years ago. But they dropped below 7% for the first time ever, or in a very long time. So there's a lot of people refinancing. So I ended up getting a job with a mortgage broker up in Marin, California. And I would go to my office in downtown San Francisco, and I'd work, and then I'd eat lunch at home, and I'd drive back to the office, and I would use their phones, and I would cold call people. And he said, look, I'll pay you $15 an hour and $500 a deal, or I'll pay you 50% of the commission. And I said, no, I need the $15. So, but my first night I did it, I got 10 deals out of it.
Wow.
And this is cold calling off like the white pages, more or less, like, which again, listeners will be like, what's the white pages? It's a list of people who own homes and their phone numbers, and that's it. and I'm cold calling them, and I end up getting a bunch of leads through the deal. And I called a friend of mine who was in the mortgage business. I said, hey, do you think I should take the $15 and the $500 a deal, or should I take the 50% commission? He's like, no, you should take the 50% commission. So I called up this guy who was my Kobe was his name. And I called Kobe, who was the broker, and I said, hey, I'm going to take the 50%. He's like, are you sure? I said, I'm sure. So fast forward, this was probably February of 2002. By April, I made $10,000.
Wow.
Now you got to imagine, I was hustling. I made nothing. I was probably $10,000 in the hole at this point. So I made 10 grand in like 2 months. And I was like, oh, I'm done. And I quit my job as a day trader. And I took that whole summer off, and I just like barely worked and just had fun. Cause I was I hadn't really had fun since I graduated college, but I was in San Francisco and I was 23 or 24 at that point. And I was surrounded by a bunch of young 20-year-olds, and we're all in our 20s. And the city this is right after the dot-com bust. So it was like empty. And it was like, we had the city to ourselves. And it was one of the best times of my life. I ended up meeting who's now my wife, and I've been with her ever since then. So I've been with my wife now for 21 years. Met her that summer, and my mortgage business started taking off, and I ended up growing Kobe's mortgage brokerage from just myself and him to around 8 people, but I was running the whole thing.
Wow.
And about 2 years into it, I said, hey man, you know, like I'm giving him half the commissions. And so he's making a ton of, he was making probably over $100,000 a year just off me. And, I said, you know, like, hey, I need something more or else I'm going to go do this for myself. And he's like, well, there's nothing else I can give you. So I left, I ended up starting my own company in July of 2003. And that was my first, that ended up being my first big success was that company. That the name of that company was Twin Capital Mortgage.
Wow. And from my understanding, that company grew quite rapidly, didn't it?
Yeah. So I started with myself and my telemarketer from when I was working with Kobe. I brought him with me and I hired an assistant. We had an office off 8th and Folsom in the South of Market District in San Francisco, which is kind of a sketchy area. One room, 500 square feet, maybe some, maybe that, maybe less, maybe it was 300 square feet. But it took off and I hit my brother up who's living in Southern California at the time. And I said, hey, why don't you come move up to San Francisco and be my business partner? And my brother was making probably 30 grand a month at this point. This is, I mean, we're like 24 and this is a long time ago.
Wow.
So he was making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I was probably making like 15,000 bucks a month, which was pretty good. Like I was the only person I knew that was making six figures. And he's like, why would I quit my job to go work with you? I'm making like twice what you're making. And I said, well, how about we do a wager? And here's how we'll do it. Now, number one is I hated his fiance. He was engaged to be married at the time. I hated his fiance. And I said, the month I make more money than you make, you have to leave your fiance and you have to move to San Francisco. And so he's like, sure, I'll take you up on that. Cause he was kind of he was on the outs with her. He was like second guessing his engagement. And so that was June or July of 2003. I opened the doors in July. And by September, I brought in $100,000 of revenue that month. That's a brand new, brand new business. I brought in $100,000 in 1 month. Now, mind you, I never even made, my best year I made was 100. I don't even think I ever made 100,000. Actually, now that I think about it, I never had even made $100,000 in a year at that point. So I made $100,000 in a month. And I swear the minute that 100,000 hit, it was September of 2003. My brother literally left his fiance the next day and drove up to a week later. And so he ended up, I had a couple assistants at that point. I think I had two or three at that point. The business was growing very rapidly. He ended up joining me that fall. And then we incorporated in January 1st, 2004, 04, 05, 06. The business ended up growing by 2,500% in revenue growth.
Wow.
So we grew from just a few of us to about 150 employees in 3 years. I did that from the age 25 to 28. We ended up being the 40th fastest growing company, number 40 in the Inc. 5000. Wow. And it was my first time growing a company. We grew the company to about $8.5 million in revenue. And it was a wild ride. I mean, like, you know, I got a business that was making millions of dollars and it was this really successful business. And I was the only person I knew, I guess a joke, I'm the only person I know who's an entrepreneur. And it was kind of true. Like this is now it's different. Everyone's an entrepreneur. Now it's like, there's tons of resources for young entrepreneurs. There's none of that stuff then. Like it was really expensive to set up a business. Getting jobs was the norm. Being an entrepreneur, an intrapreneur, like that was a really unusual thing to do. So I was the only person. I lived in San Francisco. Like the area I'm talking about, SoMa, by the way, is all startups now. If you go there, you'll see Pinterest and you'll see, you know, Airbnb. You'll see all these companies. You'll see all their offices. Back then, it was none of that. There was nothing. So I remember I said to a group of entrepreneurs when I had my first foray into like masterminding with entrepreneurs, at this program I ended up getting into at MIT, where I stood up, I said, you know, I'm a 26-year-old CEO. I'm younger than almost all my employees. And I'm the only person I know out of all my friends who's an entrepreneur.
Mm.
And all my rest of my friends are bitching about their bosses and I'm bitching about my employees. And so it was a really, you know, it was humbling. It was exciting. And it was a really, you know, it was kind of a once in a lifetime experience. And I grew a lot from that experience.
In the core business, were you just generating leads that then banks made mortgages on, or did you actually help with the mortgage side of it too?
No, as a broker. So we start off as a broker. As a broker, you generate the lead and then you broker to a bank that makes the loan.
Okay.
And you're kind of over, you're the sale, they're kind of outsourcing the sale, the sales part of it. But you have to be licensed, it's regulated. We ended up turning into what's called a broker to banker, which is you end up being, you have your own lines of credit, you fund the loan, and then you sell the loan to a bank. And so that's called a correspondent lender. So we ended up becoming a correspondent, you know, independent mortgage banker. So we were actually like a non-depository bank. By 2006, we opened our own bank. We had $20 or $30 million lines of credit, and we were funding about $30 million a month of loans. So we did about $300 million a year of lending, which is not a lot. Like, it felt like a lot then, but it, you know, being kind of where I end up, where I'll talk about that later, that was like, I would do that in a day at some points. Wow. But that's where I ended up. That's where I was then. I thought it was a big shot. So we ended up growing it. There was one really big issue though. During that time, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, the mortgage industry got kind of overtaken by essentially non-government backed loans. So these were private securitized loans, otherwise known as subprime loans. A lot of them were subprime. Most of them were alternative. We didn't even call them that then. There was some, but we called them alternative A. And so we did a lot of alt A loans, which were basically like not exactly government loans, but they were like slightly off. And so that you would have to you have to sell them to someone who was a non-Fannie, sure, non-Freddie Mac, non-Ginnie Mae. And so we were doing a ton of that business. And that became, it all got put into one bucket and called subprime just a couple years later. But we were a high growth alt A lender, which ended up becoming known as a subprime lender. And that was not a good place to be. If you ever saw the movie The Big Short,
yeah,
or read the book The Big Short by Michael Lewis, like, we were doing those types of loans. And we were doing a lot of them. We were doing them all over the United States. We had a huge call center. We were calling people all over the United States. We had a big sales staff. We had a big ops staff. We had a big underwriting staff. So I had about 150 people working for me. And the business grew again from literally nothing to almost $10 million of revenue. And this is 23, you know, this is what, 17 years ago, you know, so that'd be like running almost a $20 million business now. And I had no idea what I was doing, like none. And it was a total shit show.
Oh no.
So I know with rapid
growth, a lot of times people bring on employees that maybe aren't the best employees for the organization. Did you experience a little bit of that?
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff. Like, I was fairly picky about who came on, but you know, growing a nationwide mortgage lender in the heart of San Francisco is probably the worst place you could ever choose to do that, because your talent has the optionality of going into tech. So the really good talent's not going to pick to, in general, they're not going to pick to work for a mortgage lender. They're going to pick to work for, you know, MySpace at that time. They're going to pick to work for Google. They're going to pick to work for Twitter, you know. They're going to pick to work for probably at that point, like Cisco and like these, like, you know, old world tech businesses or Salesforce or some of them, right? They're not picking to go. If you graduate from Berkeley or from Stanford, you're not coming to, I mean, I had some of them interview, but I was not their top choice. So you're getting kind of like adversely selected from a talent standpoint. Sure. And the people who are your talent don't want to commute into San Francisco because they mostly don't live inside San Francisco. They live in the like bedroom communities. So talent became a real big issue. So there was that, some of that, and some of it was just adverse selection because of, you know, the size of the business and the industry we were in. And yeah, we weren't getting the best talent. And some of it was my lack of knowledge. I didn't know how to recruit like the right way. I thought I did a decent job considering, all things considered. But that wasn't the issue. The issue was having rapid growth and really building, you know, the right ops, the right scale systems, the right, I call it scaffolding now, the right entrepreneurial operating system, having cultural assets and strategic assets and execution assets built. I didn't have any of that stuff. So I got, you reap what you sow, and I ended up getting it was an absolute shit show. And I was constantly cleaning up the messes of the business. And it was a pretty steep learning curve. I got lucky though, because around 2006, in 2005, I was kind of at my wit's end. Because I was the CEO, I took full ownership of what was going on. We had about 60 employees at the time. And I was like, man, this company constantly has problems. Like, I'm always, and I call myself the firefighter then. I'd hop from three departments, mortgage processing, mortgage sales, and mortgage marketing, telemarketing. And I would there was always a fire going on in one of those departments. And so I would just strap on my firefighter suit and spend 30 days in processing and kind of fix it. And then sales would blow up and I'd go into sales for 30 days and fix that. And then marketing would blow up and I go into marketing, and then it would be all over again. I go back to processing, sales, and it was exhausting. I wasn't really having fun. Even though we were having record months and making a lot of money, it was like a really stressful job for me. And I was like, there's gotta be a better way of doing this. So I started looking for resources. And again, this is 2006. There wasn't the resources you have now, especially for young entrepreneurs. Mm. And so I, ended up reading an article in Inc. magazine one night around this 3-year program at MIT called Birthing of Giants, that they were partnered with MIT Enterprise Forum, Entrepreneurs Organization, and Inc. Magazine. And so I missed the deadline by like a week for the 2005 class. So I literally filled out the application that night, and I just sat on the application for literally a year. And then I turned it in like as soon as you could for 2006. And I didn't realize, but it was a really hard program to get into. They probably had like a 10% acceptance rate.
Oh, wow.
And it was from entrepreneurs all under the age of 40, high growth businesses from all over the world, at this place called the Endicott House in MIT. And so I ended up getting accepted into the 06 class, and it changed my life. I was surrounded by super high level entrepreneurs. I mean, people came out of that class were like the guys that did Rackspace, and
oh, wow.
I don't know if you know who Kendra Scott is. Kendra Scott's a graduate of the program. There's a bunch of case studies. If you followed like the scaling up methodology or EOS or anything like mm-hmm. that, a bunch of the best in class case studies from those systems came out of this program.
That's incredible.
And so, yeah, even like, I mean, we've had even a lot of people in politics. One of my class members ended up being the governor of Kentucky. Another one of my class members right now is currently the mayor of Vancouver. So there's some super interesting people in these classes. And this is out of a class of 60. I'm naming two of them are in like high level government.
Yeah.
Many large exits, many, like tons of 7, 8, 9, 10 figure exits out of these classes. I mean, like an uncountable number.
Wow.
There's been about 3,000 graduates over the last 30 years. And so I ended up being in a class and it changed my life. I started learning. The person that led my class for the first 2 years was Vern Harnish, who's of Mastering the Rockefeller Habits fame and Scaling Up. He was the person that founded the program with the group that I just talked about. And he ended up being, he was literally my teacher in my program. It was me and 59 other people. And so I learned directly from Vern the first 2 years. And then he ended up leaving and another member of EO ended up running it. So
wow,
it was a game changer, man. I really learned a lot. The issue I ran into was that the minute I knew what I was doing, or at least had an idea of what I was doing in 2007. So I went in June of 06, June of 07, and June of 08. In August of 07, my industry imploded like as hard as you can imagine. The entire private securitization market imploded. And in August of 2007, I ended up having to essentially wipe out 80% of my pipeline in 1 month.
Oh, wow.
And so I ended up having this business that was doing around $1 million a month of revenue drop literally overnight. Like in the month of August, I was supposed to do $1 million in revenue. I ended up doing 187,000 in revenue that month. And so I lost 80% of my pipeline that month. And around that time, my business had kind of flattened out. I wasn't profitable. I was breaking even. So I had $1 million of overhead and I had under 200,000 in revenue for that month.
No.
The other thing that happens, and most people don't realize this, is your expenses come in arrears. Mm-hmm. So when you're running your business with today's revenue, you're paying the month before as expenses. So I was paying for $1 million of overhead from July when I got my August revenue in August. And so there was an $800,000 delta. Now it's not like I wasn't like VC backed. I didn't have a ton of cash. I probably had $1.5 million in my company at that point.
Sure.
And so that $1.5 million turned into $600,000 overnight.
Oh, wow.
Like within a, and I was, I joked that like now that I was on a runaway train that was going over the cliff. And so we literally, now mind you, I had won number 40 in the Inc. 5000 in 2007. I just gotten that. The ceremony was in September 2007. So I was getting ready to go to Chicago for the Inc. 5000 award ceremony, black tie ceremony, to get my award for being the 40th fastest growing company in the United States. And I was literally hemorrhaging every ounce of cash I had in the business.
No.
And so we ended up, we could not cut fast enough. We ended up cutting from 150 employees down to 10 employees in 30 days.
Oh, my. What did that do to your team? I mean, with the 10 left, were they?
It was like, it just was what it was.
Sure.
Like we had no options. I mean, I had a $30,000 a month lease, and my business revenue had just dropped from $1 million to $200,000.
Hmm.
So 15% of my entire revenue just went to my rent.
How are you coping during this time?
Oh, I was a complete fucking mess. Mm. I mean, I was a complete mess. It was torture. So we ended up cutting the staff, got rid of almost everybody. I went to a skeleton staff. I ended up having to completely pivot my entire business overnight. And it was ugly. We ended up, I thought the business was going to go bankrupt. We ended up somehow getting the expenses all the way down to $200,000. Like, if you can imagine, I had $1 million overhead. I cut $800,000 of overhead in like 30 days.
Huh.
Most of it was staff, but there was, I mean, you name it, we cut it. I quit paying bills. I would just let bills pile up. I'd wait till they were net 90, then I'd pay one set of bills, and I was just managing cash. But it was sucked, you know. I ended up getting married right around then. So my wife, she was signing up for a pretty steep experience with me. But by November, I thought we were going to go out of business. By November, we ended up breaking even. And then, you know, I thought that was the worst and that we were going to be able to get out of it. But that was actually the beginning of the worst. And so at that point, I was probably 3 months into it. By April, I ended up bouncing on my lease. I was smart enough to not personally guarantee the lease. And I had they had set aside a couple $100,000. They kind of drew out of that kind of standby letter of credit. I ended up moving and sharing a 1,000 square foot office with another company in a different part of town. So I went from a 17,000 square foot state of the art office to sharing a kind of a mid-grade office with 1,000 square foot office with another company just to like get my costs down.
Yeah.
And I spent really rest of 08 and 09 pivoting the business. Eventually though, you know, the legacy issues of being in that business caught up to us. And we ended up having to shut down the business. So at the end of 2009, you know, we just couldn't figure it out. We shut the business down. And then I spent the next 2 years pivoting. I had a friend that was doing really well. He was in the B2B side of lending, and he was starting to make a lot of money. At this time, I mean, literally, you were embarrassed to tell anybody you were in the mortgage business. Mm. I mean, most people would not know this or remember this, but if you told people you were in the mortgage business in 2008, 9, 10, 11, it was like people gave you dirty looks.
Oh, no.
Because you had taken down the world economy. Just go watch the movie, The Big Short, mm-hmm. and imagine you're a mortgage broker then, or a mortgage lender then. It's like, it would be like, I don't even know. It'd be like, there's nothing really compared to now. It'd be maybe like being like a crypto bro right now who sold shit coins. That would be like, it would be the equivalent of that.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I started Dogecoin. You know, like people give you a weird look. Like, what does that even mean? You know? There isn't an equivalent right now. But it was like, it was a dirty word. You had the industry had a black eye for a really long time.
Yeah.
And it was embarrassing to tell people we were in it. It was, you know, and so it was really hard. I mean, I had a really hard time. I put on a lot of weight. I didn't make any money from 2007 to 2012. I made $0. I literally lived on savings and my wife's income. She had a job.
No paycheck at all. Literally zero.
I had a zero paycheck till 2011.
So you would have been better off just going bankrupt faster.
Hindsight being 2020, the best thing I could have done would have went BK and went and traveled for 3 years. Like, I wish I had done that. That would have been the best thing I could have done. And maybe not for myself as far as being a better business person, but being a happier human, I would have been a way happier human. I would have actually ended up net way ahead as far as like probably financially. And I should have done that. Like, Because I had built this fake dream that I'm like, hey, I'm going to build this company. And by the time I'm 30, I'm going to sell it. And I'm going to take a year off and go travel the world. I remember telling myself that. And instead, I built this company. It failed. And I struggled into my mid-early 30s to figure out what was next. And it was like there was a lot of shame and a lot of embarrassment and a lot of struggle. And I remember I had lunch one day with this girl that had worked for me previously. And she was telling me about this guy in New York who had built a $100 million company.
Hmm.
And this is probably a 2008-09. I'm running my company at this point is a $2 million company. My company was almost a 10. It was supposed to be 10 million in 07. It ended up at 6.6 because of the implosion. We were on track to do 10. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I was a $2 million company.
Wow.
So to go from a 10 to 2 and stay at 2 was really, really like it was an ego burst. Like my ego got bruised pretty hard. A lot of my friends unfriended me who used to work for, because they all worked for me. So they like weren't my friends anymore. They didn't invite me to do anything. I had been like this really cool entrepreneur. And all of a sudden I was like, kind of like this, like, at least I felt like they thought I was like a loser. And so it was, my ego was completely attached to being this successful entrepreneur. And then I got to not be a successful entrepreneur for like a pretty long time. It was a half a decade. And I felt really bad about myself. But I learned a lot through that process, you know. It made me a lot better for what came next.
So yeah, how did you turn things around going from, I mean, I appreciate the authenticity and the honesty in what you're talking about. And I can't imagine how like horrible that experience must have been, but also strengthening. But at some point here, you start to turn things around and really start to make a pretty big difference in the business world.
Yeah, I mean, you learn a lot. I learned a lot about like the legal system because I was dealing with lawsuits. I learned a lot about like what to do when you have nothing. I learned a lot how do you like build a great culture or a thriving culture with not having the means to do it, not having actual resources. I learned a lot about like running with no money. I learned a lot about building and tearing down. I learned a lot about pivoting. I got to experiment with core values a lot during that time frame. I got to experiment a lot with scale systems. I didn't scale anything, but I got to experiment with them. And so eventually a friend of mine, as I mentioned, was doing really well. He had been so small. My company was so big that it fell, right? And then I had to like deal with the aftermath of having a 150, you know, almost a $10 million company then fall, you know? And so there was just side effects of that. He had a really small company in the same space that never was successful. And because they weren't successful, they didn't have the issues. Because they didn't have the issues, he was able to be more nimble. And he ended up getting into B2B lending. So he ended up being a lender for brokers. And then he ended up becoming a lender for lenders.
Hmm.
And I saw him being really successful. And he specialized in government lending, FHA. For listeners that don't know what that is, that's like first-time homebuyer program through the government, VA for veterans, and USDA for people in agricultural areas. And that's all under Ginnie Mae, which is a government agency. And so he ended up being really, really successful. He got into that lending and I watched him doing it. And I was like, I want to go do that. I'm seeing him be successful. Ironically, I got him into the mortgage business because he saw me being successful and he ended up leaving. He was selling Yellow Page ads and ended up leaving that job to start a mortgage brokerage because he saw me doing well. And I had known him. We were pledge brothers in our fraternity in college.
Hmm.
So we'd known each other since we were 18. And so here he was being successful now. And I said, you know, I'm going to go do what he did. So I tried doing it. And mortgage lending, you need to be capitalized. So in a lot of businesses, you can kind of start with a shoestring budget, or you can start with 50 or 100 grand. Mortgage, you need $1 million just for someone to even let you do work.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have the money to do it. So I ended up doing a bunch of joint ventures in 2011. And then none of them hit that well. But by the end, I made a little bit of money. That was the first paycheck I took. And then, you know, I said, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. In 2012, I ended up joining his business. And I had built up all this like muscle from doing all the stuff I just talked about. And his business was ran like garbage. It was just like, I mean, he was in the right place at the right time and he had the right platform. And in mortgage lending, you could get pretty far with that.
Hmm.
You didn't even have to run the business that well. And my former head of banking, I got her a job with him. She became his head of banking. Like this is a couple years earlier. And I saw him doing well, so I partnered with him, and I ended up growing the hell out of his business. We had a little bit of a falling out, so right when I started getting a ton of traction, he ended up bringing in the group who ran Lehman Brothers into the ground, and they ended up taking over as like the C-suite of his business.
Huh.
And we had a huge cultural clash, like, because we were, the business was crushing. It was making like over $1 million a month of profit.
Wow.
And I was, and I had like a joint venture, so I was making pretty good money with him. And these guys came in, the first thing they're like, those guys are making too much money. And they figured a way to get us out of the business and to try to take the business. So long story short, I was there for about 2 years. I got squeezed out, essentially because this new group came in. It was like not super kosher, but it ended up being the best thing that happened to us, because the team that built that business there, I mean, we were the operators. And although we didn't own the platform, we all had joint ventures with the platform. We were just entrepreneurs. We were like almost intrapreneurs that weren't paid a salary. We were paid based off our profit. So we were really building a business within a business. So I said, well, I just built this here. I'm going to take all of it. I'm going to bring it somewhere else. So I ended up trying to buy a platform. I raised a bunch of money, tried buying a platform. That didn't go well. It was the first time I got an M&A. And then I said, you know what? Maybe I can do another partnership, but I got to do it different this time. So there was a company that we had tried to buy out of New York called The Money Source. And I ended up reaching back out to them and said, hey, you know, I know you don't want to sell, but would you be interested in doing a joint venture? But I'm going to tell you right now, I just got out of a joint venture that didn't go well. So like, I'm going to give you a list of 10 things that need to be true, or else there's nothing for us to talk about. And the 10 things were like my must-haves. And he agreed. And I said, okay, well, here's 40 things I need to have. If you're agreeable to this, I'll get on a plane and come and see you in New York. And we could talk about me essentially building a company within a company. And his business was very small then. Now, he had all the raw ingredients that I needed. He had the licensing I needed. He had the bank relationships I needed. And he had the state licensing I needed. And that's all I needed. I just needed his license. I didn't need anything. I didn't need operations. I didn't need tech. I didn't need anything except the license. And that was literally all I needed, was the license. And I said, look, I'll do a 50-50 deal with you. I'm going to build my business within your business. And then within 3 years, I'm going to spin off. And I'm going to take all my assets with me, and you're going to own a piece of the next business. And so that was the original deal I did with The Money Source. We did the exact same thing I had done at the previous business, which was called Pacific Union Financial. And it went vertical. This was a very small business. It maybe had a few million dollars of net worth total, had 20, 30 people working there. We were really running our own business separate, just using their licensing. But the business grew from really zero, us, to 300 employees in 18 months.
Oh, wow.
And the net worth of the business grew from like, you know, $6-7 million to over $40 million in 18 months. So right when that happened, I found a platform in San Diego to buy, and I went to try to buy it. It was actually one of the platforms I had tried buying previously. The guy that bought it ended up kind of running into the ground, and we tried buying it. In the process of trying to do that deal, we figured out there was a bunch of tax ramifications of doing the deal that didn't work. We couldn't move the assets without triggering a taxable event. So my partner came to me and said, hey guys, look, you can't move the assets like you want to. Why don't we do a different deal? We're going to take your joint venture, and you guys will become owners in this business. And you guys will end up buying a big piece of this business through, like, we'll do a capital raise through, like, you know, through private equity or through debt. We'll figure it out. And Darius, you'll become the CEO. You'll merge your business with my business. It'll be a merger, like almost a reverse merger. And it'll be the four of us as owners. And so we ended up agreeing to that deal, ended up growing the business from 300 to 1,000 people in the next 18 months, grew the value of the business to almost $200 million in literally 3 years.
Wow. What was that journey like for those 3 years?
I mean, a lot of ups and downs. I mean, the mortgage business is very volatile because it's interest rate driven. The big thing that went in our favor was we had a really good blueprint that we took from Pacific Union. And then that ended up having some issues, which I don't need to get into because it's technical. But then we ended up, Brexit happened in 2016. And that was very good for interest rates. They made like an all-time low. It was like, if you think of interest rates during COVID, most people that know interest rates will know that interest rates went to almost zero. Prior to that, that happened in Brexit as well. So our business, I mean, it was making tens of millions of dollars of profit because of that in just a given year. I think we made, I want to say, we grew the revenue. I want to say the revenue was probably at the most like 10 to 12 million bucks when I first got there. And that was 2013. And by 2016, it was 209 million. and top line revenue.
So not only are you building a super successful business, but you're doing it in a better way than you've done before. I know you were getting some pretty impressive awards during this time, right?
Yeah. So I learned a lot. You know, like I said, I kind of got taken to school and with Twin Capital, the first business. And then with those 5 years, I call it being an entrepreneurial purgatory. Hmm. So I was like, I was really like, I'm a learner and I'm a growth minded person. So I just like, you know, and I'm not perfect, man. It was very tough. I got hard. I joke that I'm like, for anyone that's familiar with Vietnam, I'm like a guy that had 5 tours in Vietnam. So like I was like a war torn, like I was tough. By the end of those 5 years, I was a tough person. Like you did not want to be on the other side of deals with me if you were trying to do dumb shit. Like I was, you know, I had dealt with enough bad situations that I knew it was terrain that I was comfortable with. I didn't like it. And I still don't like doing that stuff. I don't like conflict, but like, I'm not afraid of it either. But the other thing I learned was how to scale a business. And so the joint venture I had at, you know, I just had this too big, like, you know, I didn't go into it too much, but at Pacific Union, the business grew to almost $75 million in revenue in like overnight. And then the deal kind of fell apart. And then I brought everyone I had brought there over to the new business. And then it went to, you know, we grew it, you know, 30X or whatever that number is, 20X in 3 years. 0 to 300, startup to 300 employees was a piece of cake. That was when I actually won the award for highest rated CEO in America, or number 9 highest rated CEO in America. We were the number 3 best place to work in San Francisco.
Wow.
And, you know, like, which if you could imagine, like, your competition there, this is in 2016, you're competing against every top tech startup in the whole country. You know, so I had learned, how do you build an amazing culture? How do you build one for scale? How do you build a core value driven organization? How do you leverage that to make it a high growth business? How do you leverage that so that it's a place people want to be a part of that's greater than themselves? I had figured a lot of that stuff out over the years. I had been experimenting so much that I had some tools that I could use.
What were some of those key tools? What really made the difference for you?
You know, my tool of choice was core values. So I had, you know, when on my last night of graduation at Birthing a Giants at MIT, there was two guys that had this great company called Nurse Next Door, John DeHart and Ken Sim. Ken, who I mentioned earlier, is now he's literally the mayor of Vancouver. They had a stand up. It's a stand up if your company has core values. Now, mind you, we're taught scaling up, and a lot of people now do EOS. That was kind of born out of scaling up. This is stand up if your company has core values. So we all stood up because, of course, we were taught we need to have core values. It says stay standing if you say your core values at the top of your head. Half the room sits down. I'm in that group. And it was a gut punch. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just sat down. I'm a pretty competitive person. Didn't feel good. It says stay standing if your employees know your core values. I'm looking around the room. Half the remaining half sits down. So 3/4 of the room sitting down now. And I'm like, 3/4 of the room, these are the CEOs I respect. They don't know their core values, and their team doesn't know their core values. And they said, stay standing if your customers know your core values. Everyone sits down. And I was just like, you know, for whatever reason, it was, you know, I've had a couple major pivotal points in my life. And that was one of the, that was a major one. It just stuck with me, and it ruminated and it resonated with me. And I was like, you know, why is this? This doesn't make sense. So the next morning I was sitting at a diner after I graduated from my program at MIT. This is the end of year 3. My business at this point's like gotten crushed, but I was like, you know, like, why did nobody know the core values? Like, I'm kind of a creative at heart. And I was like, you know, I could guarantee you they don't know them because they're hard to remember, you know? And I had 6 values, 76 words. Of course I didn't know what they are. I still don't know what they are. And I wrote a book about them, for Christ's sake. But I said, you know, we really stand for 4 things: working hard, doing the right thing, you know, being innovative, and, you know, giving great service. And I was like, well, what's an easy way to remember those? And I'm like, well, working hard, why don't we call it do work? You know, doing the right thing, karma, live zen. You know, be thinking outside the box, break the box. Giving great service, wow everyone. Do work, live zen, break the box, wow everyone. And then I wrote like 4 to 6 sentences under what each of those meant. And I was like, and I went back and taught my team it. And I started to figure out that you can design your company the way, if you think of a company as an organism that you can design, what are you doing to intentionally design it for the outcome you want? So I just got really geeky. I started geeking out on values, and I designed them for, because core values are the fundamental beliefs of a person or organization. I was like, well, if I could, I said, you know, like, no one has to tell me to work hard. No one has to tell me to do the right thing. No one has to tell me to like make sure I dot my I's and cross my T's. Nobody has to tell me to under promise and over deliver. I just do it. Like, so I said, what if I got a room full of people that just did that stuff organically? They would have to share the same values. And so I got really intentional about designing values and then really making sure people knew what they were and using them in the business and then hiring for them. And when I went to and I started experimenting with it over the years. And then by the time I got to the money source, I had at least the first draft of my process. And so about 18 months in, I was at a team build. We would do these core value rollouts, which I talk about in my book. It's chapter 6 of my book, The Core Value Equation. And I would roll out the core values, and I have this whole process to indoctrinate people into the values. And we would do these big team builds afterwards. And mind you, I'm like hiring like 20 people a month at this point. You know, my biggest month, Mike, I hired 140 people in 1 month.
Wow.
And I would bring them in classes of 20 and teach them the values. Me as a CEO, I would do this like, it was a full day in my Birthing the Giants program, I ended up meeting Simon Sinek in 2009. I ended up learning that you need to have a why. I mean, like literally he was a nobody and there was like 30 of us in a room and him. And so I had befriended him. I learned you need to have a why. I knew you had to have purpose. Our why at TMS was to grow happiness. We had our four values: people matter, inspiring leadership, strength of character, rock solid service. We had descriptors of what those meant. We had our BHAG, for those people that don't know, that's Jim Collins, like big, hairy, audacious goal. Our BHAG was to help 1 million people gain and retain home ownership in the next 10 years. They hit it. It took them 9.5 years to do it. So I had all these, I call these cultural assets that I'd built, and I had figured out a way to teach people that and then hold them accountable to it. And so at this team build I was at, I remember I was sitting there and I overheard employees talking, and they didn't know I was listening, and they were talking in core value language.
Wow.
And I realized I had created a language for my organization. And so I got really jazzed on this, because the greatest thing that had happened was, this is, you know, 18 months into the business, we had 300 people there. We had no infrastructure, but I had people showing up doing great work. The business is growing like crazy. I'd have none of the systems you would think you would need to manage 300 people, but it was seamless. I had off the chart employee engagement scores. I had off the chart client experience scores, and I didn't have any of the infrastructure outside of just measuring that stuff and teaching values to get me. And I realized that I created this like invisible manager in the business, which were the values, and they were kind of policing everybody. Now that worked, and that got us a ton of awards. I ended up winning the Glassdoor award. We won Best Places to Work. We won Great Company award through Fortune magazine. We were winning like award after award after award. But when we scaled to 1,000 over the next 18 months, like it broke, right? I mentioned I hired 140 people in 1 month. There's only 21 working days in a month. That's hiring 7 people a day, you know, and these were all over the United States. And so I was breaking my team and end up, you know, the mortgage industry is very volatile. So we ended up, the rates shot up after Trump got elected. I ended up shrinking the business down to about 500 people. And then I was very intentional about rebuilding it back to 1,000. And I did that over the next 3 years. And it, you know, it was painful. The first going from 300 to 1,000, it was painful to take it from 1,000 down to 500. I mean, you got to imagine we let go of almost 500 people. And then, you know, but I was very thoughtful about rescaling it. And that second time around, it was rather easy. You know, again, I had learned it was not my first time growing 1,000-person organization at that point. I had just done it 18 months earlier. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that was it was a wild ride, man.
Yeah, that's such a crazy ride, but it's interesting to hear how you learned important lessons and reapplied them as you grew. Kind of as you look back now, what would you have told yourself after the 2007 crisis and when you're going through the doldrums? What would you have coached or encouraged yourself during that time?
I would have said you should leave this industry. I would have convinced myself to leave.
Sure. How about for people that want to achieve the level of success you've done, what tips, tricks, things, encouragement would you give them if they want to follow a similar path?
Depends on the person. You know, I think, you know, I mean, you know, we're going to that, to the point with the company where, you know, I ended up actually falling out of love with the company in 2019, and I ended up leaving, and it was a very, I was 41 years old. It was a very, very, emotional and like trying, it was emotionally and probably spiritually, it was as trying of a time for me as it was in 2007 and eight, if not worse.
Really?
And so I ended up leaving the business. We almost sold the business through an investment banking process. We were in final diligence when COVID hit. We had a publicly traded company that was going to buy the company for, you know, multiple nine figures. And the deal fell apart because of COVID. I ended up getting bought out by my business partners. And then I spent a couple of years really exploring, like, what's next for myself, climbing that next mountain. And, you know, I think life happens, can happen to you or for you. And I think I had the perspective that life always happened to me before. And I've changed that perspective now that life happens for you. And I think that your industry needs to, you know, probably the reason I said I would have convinced myself to leave the industry is I don't think the fundamentals of the mortgage space are actually aligned with who I am as a human being.
Ooh, and powerful. So
it's a great business in that you help a lot of people get into homes. And I'm generalizing. There are parts of the business that for sure do. And you know, I end up growing, you know, the business I grew at TMMS was we ended up managing, today they manage $90 billion of mortgage servicing assets. We built a state-of-the-art mortgage servicing software. We ended up, you know, I mentioned that I was funding about $30 million a month of loans. I would sell those loans to a company like The Money Source. So I ended up being like the person who was the client for me when I was a client. Like I was the client, I was the person that I would have sold the loan to when I was new to the business. So I ended up kind of going way up the food chain in the business. It was a very sophisticated business. And there's parts of it that probably do fit my personality to a certain degree, but the business is very volatile. And I'm not a very volatile person. I'm kind of a steady Eddie person. The business, because it's volatile and cyclical, it's probably one of the most volatile and cyclical businesses in the world. Why? Because the interest rates go up, there's less demand. The interest rates go down, there's excess demand. And so you have this really feast or famine type business, and that just isn't me as a person.
Yeah.
So what ends up happening is you end up having to add a lot of people really quickly, and you have to cut them very quickly, because if rates go from 3% to 5%, like the demand for your product drops by 50% overnight. And very few businesses have something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now it built a lot of muscle. I'm an athlete when it comes to growth now, you know, but emotionally it took its toll on me. And I was sitting, you know, I ended up selling a business in 2017 and 18 were tough years for the mortgage business. Most people don't know that. Right now is the worst it's ever been because of interest rates. But 17 and 18 were really tough after Brexit. And in the beginning of 19, my business partners and I decided to sell our entire retail business, which had about 400 employees, to a large lender in the United States. And so we sold the business. And I was sitting in my car on the... This happened on like a Monday. I had to fly to Arizona where we were headquartered. I live in Austin. I came home. It was really emotional. There was a lot of people I'd worked with for almost 10 years that were part of that group. They trusted me. And I just felt like, you know, I just felt like I was done. It was the seventh round of layoffs I'd ever done in my business. It was, you know, I probably in that business laid off close to 2,000 people. You know, I've grown, I've added 5,000, I've laid off 2,000. And I was sitting in my car, at that point, I was 40 years old. And I was sitting in my car and on a Saturday afternoon, and my wife and kids left the house, or sorry, they left the car to go to an art store. And I was sitting there and I was like, and I looked in my rearview mirror and I remember I had this moment where I threw up the words, I'm going to quit. And like, I it was not, there was no like cognition. It happened physically. And I was like, whoa, what did I say? And I forgot to tell you, going back to 2009, I said I had lunch with this girl that I worked with, and she was telling me about this guy that had built a $100 million company. She called him the $100 million guy. And I remember I was running my $2 million company at that point. I didn't finish that story. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to build a $100 million company. Now, mind you, I had that thought to myself when I was running a $2 million failing company. And it took me 5 years to do that. From the moment I had that thought, from that thought in 2010, I hit 100 million in 2015.
Wow.
And so here I was 4 years later throwing up the words, I'm going to quit my $200 million company that I had dreamed about 9 years earlier, that I had manifested 5 years later. And here I was hating it and wanting to leave. And so, you know, I recently learned in the, you know, kind of going through this transition in my life that, you know, you should imagine what, if you got what you want, what would it actually look like? And I read that in a book recently, and it was a question I wrote down. I said, how many people actually do that? Honestly tell themselves, what will it look like if I get what I want?
Not many.
What might it not look like? I never would have thought that if I got what I want, I would have felt that way. But the reality is I knew enough about the business where if I really thought about it, I might have realized that, yeah, there's going to be these big ups and big downs, and how will I actually feel about that? Now, I tell you, I would have said, like, fuck it, I'll do it anyway. I don't care. Not knowing how it's going to feel. It's like having kids. Like, people that have kids, are like, it's hard to explain to someone what it feels like to have a kid until you have a kid. You have to live that experience in order to know. I had to live the experience in order to know. So I would tell someone, the advice I'd give anybody is, think about what will happen if you actually get what you want. Will you actually, what will you do then? Because for me, I felt pretty empty inside when it happened. And that led me down a really interesting road. I called it the abyss. I got thrown into the abyss the last couple of years. And I've now just coming out of it. And it's interesting to see the next mountain I'm climbing right now. It's a much, much more aligned and interesting mountain.
Well, I know we're running up near our end of our time, but briefly, would you kind of tell us a little bit what your dream now is for the future?
Yeah, like I've gotten really clear that I don't have big goals like I did before. Let me take that back. I do have big goals, but they don't come in the form of goals. I only care about three things now. And every day I set daily goals to level up to my bigger goals. Or my bigger B's, I call them. And it's, who do I want to be in the world? And so for me, the three B's is, I want to be someone that creates impact in the world. I want to be someone who's healthy. And I want to be someone who has deep relationships with people that I love. And then I break those down into three sub areas. How do I want to be someone that creates impact? I want to do it through advising entrepreneurs and CEOs. I want to do it through my private equity business. And I want to do it through podcasting. So I have I'm working on all those areas. I'm raising over $200 million right now for a private equity business I'm starting. I advise a few different companies, and that's what I've been doing the last couple of years. And I have some deep relationships there with people I care about. And I have a podcast right now called The Greatness Machine that's one of the top 50, you know, business podcasts in the United States. So I always want to create value there. On the health, it's mind, body, and spirit. Am I eating right? Am I exercising? Am I, you know, doing my meditation and, you know, am I just feeding my soul? Right. Mm-hmm. And then on the relationship side, it's my wife, my kids, and my friends. And I look at my friends in two buckets, my friends here in Austin and my friends all over the world. And what am I doing to enhance those relationships and deepen those relationships every day? And I look at all those nine areas every single day, and I set daily goals around at least three of them. And that's all I care about.
That's incredible. I love the clarity of that, because then it helps you achieve what you truly want rather than this abstract goal that could get you where you don't want to be. Man, that's amazing. You know, for our audience, what is the best way to find you, to get in contact, to learn more about what you do?
Yeah, you know, like a couple ways. I have a website, The Real Darius, so www.therealdarius.com. My book, The Core Value Equation, if you're building an organization, if you're an entrepreneur, if you want to build, if you want to create, I call it a framework for invisible scale in your business, you should read The Core Value Equation. It's a great complement. If you've read Traction or you read Scaling Up or, you know, even, Profit First, my friend Mike McCallowitz wrote, like if you read any of those books, this is a really good complement to those books. You read The Hard Thing that, you know, by, what's his face? I'm blanking on his name right now. But yeah, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, like this is a good complement to those books, because it actually tells you how to do it. How do you build a core value driven existence? And my the greatest one, I think, is my podcast. I was like, you know, rarely am I interviewed. Normally I'm interviewing, but you know, we're interviewing some amazing people. We interviewed Moby last month. We interviewed, you know, Gabby Reese, and we interviewed Bruce Buffer and Chris Voss and a lot of really interesting folks. I'll do those interviews on Wednesdays. And then on Fridays though, Justin Donald, who is someone I interviewed, which is how I met you, Mike. But yeah, a lot of cool people. We're interviewing Morgan Housel, who wrote The Psychology of Money. We have an interview with him this fall. So a lot of interesting folks are coming on the show. That show's been around for a couple years, and it's, you know, top ranked show on iTunes and all those other, you know, platforms. But you know, the biggest thing is just, hitting me up on all those different areas, on the podcast. I'd say Fridays I do solos. And solos are a lot like I cherry pick my greatest lessons in life. And I usually will talk about them for 10 to 15 minutes every Friday. And I have a list of them, and it's everything from, like, you know, one I call like the biggest lie in the world of when I get there, X will happen. When X happens, Y was how I'll feel. And I just walk through my experiences, a lot of the stuff I've been doing here for the last hour and a half, but it's in bite size, it's quick. And they're the things I'm like, man, I wish someone had told me this, you know? And I get it. Most entrepreneurs who want to like grow the big business, the, you know, multi hundreds of millions of dollar business, $1 billion business, I would just ask them, why do you want to do that? And be honest with yourself. Is it because you want to feel important? Is it because you think once you get that, your life will change? I have enough friends now that are worth minimum of $100 million that don't have to do anything. And half of them are bored out of their mind. And because that's not the answer. I'm not saying having means does not give you options. I'm saying be honest with yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Because the one thing you don't get back in this world, and Justin talks a lot about this, is your time. How time wealthy are you? And you don't get it back. And so there's a lot of time I spent that I would go back and change, which is why I have some of, you know, if I want to say I have regrets, some of my regrets were me chasing the dollars at the expense of life experiences I will never be able to go back and get. And so it's not to say that I'm still grinding. I'm a grinder. I love getting after it. I mean, I'm trying to build a multi-billion-dollar private equity business right now. But I'm not doing it for the intention of growing a multi-billion-dollar business. I'm doing it with the intention of creating impact in the world. It's different. So I don't really care what the number is. I care about the impact. And there's a saying I'll end on, you know, I have a friend that taught me this, which is the more money you have makes you more of what you already are. And so you can't escape who you are. You can't have an exit and go travel. You're bringing whoever you are, wherever you are. And the question I would ask is, who are you bringing with you? Are you bringing someone that's full of gratitude and joy and happiness and enjoys every moment and appreciates what they have? Or are you bringing someone that's never going to be satisfied, that's chasing a hungry ghost to the next place they're going to go and that bar is going to raise? You're going to be like how I was, where it's like, all I want to do is build $1 million business. And then once I built $1 million business, the number went to 5 million. And once it went to 5, it went to 10. And then I got stuck there for a while, but I said, I want to build 100. And I built 100 and went to 200. And at 200, I realized there is no end. I remember I was at 200. I'm like, there is no end. 500. If I hit 500, I'll feel no different. In other people's eyes, it looks successful. In my own eyes, it was nothing. It was a vanity metric. The most important thing is, are you living the life that you want to live?
Yeah.
And are you doing it in a way that aligns to who you want to be? And that's why I kind of ended with what I was talking about before, is who are you trying to be in the world? And get clear on that, and then go build daily goals to go make that shit happen. And for me, I went from being a person that was chasing everything to chasing those things I just mentioned. And it's around showing up, being who I'm supposed to be every day, to be a healthier version of myself, to create impact in the world and deepen my relationships. And anything that's, it's real easy filter when things are outside of the, if it's not honoring those things, those three areas, I'm like, it's an easy no. So that's actually I'm writing a new book right now, and it's specifically this framework. So
that's outstanding. You know. Well, thank you so much. This has been so much fun. And what I really was impressed by is just the authenticity, right? Being honest about the struggles, the challenges, and also the benefits, and then realigning yourself now later in life. It's incredible. So thank you for joining today.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me here.